So I'm really excited to introduce to you this morning my friend, Dr. Adam Weiss. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Jody. It's great to be here.
Well, and it's always nice. I'm not going to lie. I mean, you're not my personal doctor, but just to be able to hang out and have a conversation with a doctor where I'm not telling you something that's wrong with me feels kind of fun.
Yeah, I know. It's different for me too. That's great. That's,
you're like, finally, I just get to hang out and have coffee.
Yeah, and Lord knows I like to talk, so that's all good.
It's good. Well, for those who may not know you, Dr. Weiss, you've been a doctor in the High River area for quite some time, and you were, gosh, I want to say an integral piece, and I probably don't have the right terminology or research behind what to say, but people would have seen High River in the news when the pandemic was really in full swing last year, and High River kind of got put on the map again for something a little more disastrous like floods. We had a pretty large outbreak here, and you were leading that team to, I don't know if the right word is to contain or what that looks like, but you were integral in getting that stopped and really supporting those families through that process. That must have been wild.
Yeah, it's pretty surreal. It's 11 months ago this past weekend, actually. Yeah. So COVID became a reality to me and to our healthcare team in a big, big way. We had started to imagine some worst case scenarios, and this one had crossed our mind, but we had no idea that how bad it would be. And we were just really, really, as a combination of good fortune, good planning, we had a pandemic plan prepared that we had signed off on like 2 weeks before the first cases started coming in. And I happened to be the primary care network chair. So that was my responsibility to be devising that plan and coming up, you know, sort of working with operational people. So when it hit, it was like, here we go. But there was lots of parts of it that we hadn't figured out.
Yeah.
So we had the straw dog, so to speak, but the actual mechanisms for doing some of the things we really needed we had to figure out on the fly. And it was phenomenal, Jody. Like it really, people have no idea how the team kind of came together. And when I say team, I mean from provincial Alberta Health Services senior managers in Edmonton all the way down to our local staff in the lab.
Yeah.
Our lab staff was amazing. To primary care network. I mean, our girls in the primary network, they're all women.
They just happened to be.
But they became world experts in how to manage a massive outbreak in a small town in the space of about a week and a half. So, it was phenomenal.
Well, I think that the average person, we have no idea what happens in the background. We have no idea how many players need to execute something. We only know what we're see or told through the media, which is why I'm like, does your son really want to go in journalism? No, I'm just kidding. We don't really know. And that was part of the reason I wanted to connect with you and have a chat, was just to let people see in a little bit with that and get a look behind the scenes as to what goes on. And I think that it's easy to criticize what is or isn't happening in the world because we don't really know and we don't really understand. It's hard to wrap our brains around that. I don't know if we ever will.
Well, it's been fascinating. This one of the things that's been a real eye opener in the last year has been this massive flip in virtual care, virtual platforms, virtual communication, and it's just taken medicine and cracked it open like it was this secret society almost, and it's opened it up and made it visible for everybody to see. And now you have people that are smart people, but have no expertise or facility with even the language, who are looking at it going, what's this? What's that? Right. And there's open discussion and there's commentary and criticism. And it's, to me, I don't know. I think letting people have a look in what's under the hood allows them to be more invested. I mean, some people prefer just not to know, like, don't confuse me. Just tell me what to do. Right. Like there's that. And that's okay too. But lots of other people feel better when they have some confidence because they know, they feel like they know.
Well, each person wants to educate themselves differently on the decision. And that was part of when you and I talked last week about getting together this morning, was just, there's a lot of what you're calling in your field is vaccination hesitation. And that's, in our terms over here, we're like, do I get that thing or not? And yeah. I wanted to talk a bit about the vaccine, if you're cool with that, and try to help educate people to make that decision. And I always say, whether you're somebody who wants to get the vaccine or you're somebody who doesn't, you are loved equally. We are in a respectful place, but I want to give people the opportunity to learn a little bit more about it. And so I'm sure you've answered all the questions 1,001 times, but we're going to do 1,002 today and just have you share a little bit about that. And you're on a team that's actually helping to give some public education to the hesitation people are facing.
Yeah, I think we recognized actually back in the summer that this was going to be something we needed to do. And slowly ideas percolated. I had a resident doctor, Dr. Fionnuala Hackett, working with me for 6 months in High River. And I suggested to her, hey, how about you get involved with the schools? And we struck up a partnership with Foothill School Division, and that sort of snowballed into these community outreach, first of all, around the school population and parents and teachers and so on. But we've done a couple of broader community outreach programs. And I think what we've recognized is that people just need to have that familiar voice. They need to have a familiar face to let them feel confident that what they're hearing in the big wide world is actually has some local validity. You know what I'm saying? So I think that we've got really good response from it. Not huge numbers of people involved with it, but it's got great feedback. So I think it's really important.
Well, and I think, we're in a world now where information, correct or incorrect, is just a click away. And I mean, it's not maybe the world's first pandemic, but it's the world's first pandemic where we have the technology that we have behind it. And so there's probably an interesting twist for those who have looked back to, okay, how does history repeat itself and what does that look like? We're in a totally different world for that. And I think that probably plays part in with, we're in a totally different world in vaccination or vaccine creation. So I know people a lot are, how did they make it so quickly? How do they know it's safe? Like how do you answer that?
Yeah. So I started my science life off doing general science. I thought I was going to be a benchtop researcher. So we were talking earlier. I've been, the science world has been part of my life since I was probably 17 or 18. And back then, we knew obviously what DNA was all about, and we knew how DNA was translated and made proteins and all these functions. But we didn't have any way then of figuring out easily what the code of DNA was. Like that was if you had to figure out a little piece of DNA to sort out how it got to what the code was for a specific protein, it would take like months and months and months to figure that out. Well, since then, the technology's developed so that now you can plug that into a computer and the sequencing process happens. And basically, so this science behind this has been, I mean, it's 40 years in the making at least. And so now what we have the ability to do for not just vaccines, but any genetically based process is to have a sequence of what the gene is that makes a protein. And it basically is like a code. Imagine an alphabet with four letters. And those are the four bases that make up DNA. And so you just have a code of four letters that tells you what the structure is of this DNA. And so what they did is they used that to figure out what the code is for the protein on the coronavirus. And everybody's heard of the spike protein. So this is the piece of the protein on the outside of the virus that attacks your body or sticks on the cells of your body and gets into your body, and that's how it causes the infection. So what they figure is if they make a vaccine with that protein, then your body will be able to attack the virus as it's trying to enter your body. The Chinese, back in middle of January last year, published on open source, published the sequence of the DNA that codes for that protein. And I know all the researchers that made the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, they had the mRNA, which is it's complicated, but it's like a reverse code of that. It's like an intermediate step. They had that made by the end of January, early February.
Yeah.
And so then it's just a matter of going into production and figuring out how to get that material into the human body in a way that it will cause an immune reaction.
Right.
And that technology was parallel being developed over the last 30 years as well, of trying to get new ways of getting vaccines made, but they just never had the opportunity to use it. So the other thing that happened, if you don't mind my rambling, but yeah. The other cool part was, if you're a vaccine maker, it's like the perfect laboratory is like a world that's just absolutely rampant with this infection. So if you want to test how effective it is, it's easy to find people that are going to come into contact with the virus and to see what the response is. You vaccinate 40,000 people in a week, and then a month from now, they've all, like, you look at the cases in the US, for example, how many cases they had. It was everywhere. And those people are exposed, and in a month, you know whether it's effective or not.
Yeah.
Most vaccines, like your shingles vaccine, we only get a few cases of shingles a year per 100
yeah.
or whatever, right? Or per 1,000. So you have to wait years to figure out if it's going to work or not. So that's the difference there, is they were then able to, they had this technology, was sitting there ready to go. They put it into action and tested it, like, and the tests were done by March or April last year, the effectiveness, they knew they had something that worked.
Yeah. Well, I think too, people need to realize that, I would think, and I mean, again, this is my assumption that you can correct, but I'm not sure we've ever had a stage in creating a vaccine where everybody was working together per se. You know, it's normally very, it would be like corporate espionage or patent protecting things. And we had this open, I mean, would people have published open codes before or whatever that looked like? We had this big stage of sharing because we all had a common good and a whole heck of a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, we would have done that in the past, but it would have got published in a journal of DNA science or something or other. And it would have been the first of next year.
Yeah.
You know, and then you get it in the mail and everybody would look at the journal and read it, right? So that's how it happened in the past. But this, I mean, it's the pros and cons, but the ability to publish it online, make it available, skirts around some of our scientific protection. So part of the scientific process is peer review and having it reviewed by other scientists and making sure that it's accurate and has validity and is reproducible and all those sorts of things. But that's way more difficult when something's just posted online. It's very easy to test it.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting point for people to know too, is that when you talk about science protection, so the fact that somebody doesn't just make it and it's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure this is it, let's give it a go. Like, it's going through a number of people, a number of scientists before it's put out on the market. Like, it feels like, I think to us as a consumer, that it was like, ta-da, we have vaccine in a bottle for you today. But there's so much more behind that.
Yeah. And I think I don't know the inner workings of the vaccine manufacturing process, but I do know that their ability to quality control that type of thing is very, very high. I think that the techniques for purifying it are really they're phenomenal. It's, if you can't get into it here, but it just is, it's amazing. So, and yeah, the double checking and triple checking, I mean, nobody can afford to make big mistakes. I mean, could something little be made better next time? Maybe. I don't know. Can there be little mistakes that happen in there? Sure. And it does happen fast. So there is that possibility. But I think that just the whole you know, like the whole process of figuring out whether it worked and whether it was safe in the short term was, like, as I said before, like it happened so fast. There was so many people infected. There was so many patients, so many people, subjects to test it on, right? That were going to get exposed. And that all happened, you know, very, very quickly. So they were able to see the safety data and everything right away. So I don't know. It's never happened like this before. This is brand new. This all, like all the pieces that have all come together.
Now, do you find people are feeling hesitant about it because we don't know what long-term side effects look like or side effects in general? Is that something that you're finding is really concerning?
You know, we know that people are hesitant. We've done some research on this. And we know people are hesitant for a number of different reasons. I mean, some people just discount the notion of vaccines in general, for whatever reason. But the majority of people who are hesitant are more in the long-term safety, the specific impact that it's going to have on my health parameters. I'm suspicious of the process. I'm suspicious of the regulation. There has to be something behind this that's a profit motive that, you know, trumps everything, trumps safety. There's people who are just generally fearful and would rather somebody else, I want to see what happens to everybody else before I get it. So there's lots of different reasons for it. It's not just a one size fits all, which is perhaps what you'd expect, but it makes it a little bit more challenging to develop a public messaging because you can't use fear tactics because that just scares some people even more, right? And you can't be all bubbly and promoting it as, hey, this is awesome, because that feeds into the people who are suspicious about it. So I think it really has to be measured and has to be open, and we have to just listen to what people are worried about and just try and answer their questions the best we can.
So how do you answer the question about side effects?
Well, what I know is that over the course of a year, the side effects of this vaccine are like almost negligible. If we had a drug that we were giving you for high blood pressure with the side effect profile of this, we probably would barely even touch on what the side effects are. I mean, a sore arm for a day is by far and away the most common side effect. A minor flu-y kind of feeling for a day or two is probably the number two thing. And beyond that, it's like really we get down to numbers that are less than 1 in 100. So the short-term side effects we know are almost negligible. The long-term side effects, so we have now the first cohort of 40,000 people were vaccinated a year ago. And those group have not had any signaling of any autoimmune diseases or there was a scare with the AstraZeneca early on, blanked. It was an autoimmune phenomenon, but basically it was a couple of cases that were random, didn't show up anywhere else. You know, we've got this thing in the news today. I don't mind talking about that because people read about that, about the blood clot issues. And, you know, that the numbers I saw this morning were 37 blood clots in 11 million vaccinated patients. If you do the math on that, that's not very many, like, you know, 3 per million. We expect 2 per 100,000 blood clots per year per person on average. If you're a smoker, it's more like 10 per 100,000, which is 100 per million.
Yeah.
We're talking 37 per 11 million, right? So I think we don't know anything about the breakdown of that. And this is, again, the problem. So everybody wants transparency. So this hits the news. Oh my gosh, there's 37 per 11 million. And Germany shuts down AstraZeneca use.
Yeah.
And they say, we're going to pause and look at this. I don't know. I heard, my friend Raj Bardwaj was on CBC this morning, and his line was, you know, we prefer to make a mistake from doing nothing rather than to make a mistake from doing something. We prefer errors of omission rather than error of commission. And The problem with this, obviously, is that the side effects of COVID-19 disease, which is, let's face it, is out there in significant numbers, is way higher than the side effects of the vaccine.
It's kind of like you have to measure which risk, I guess, for lack of a better term, you would want to go down that path. Like,
well, I'm a math guy, and for me, it's a no-brainer as a math guy.
Yeah.
And I know that most people aren't math people.
No, you're a special breed. Yeah.
So I take the emotion out of it. Math doesn't think about emotion. but I mean, in the U.S., 1 in 500 Americans have died. So nobody's died from the vaccine. And that's how many, I don't know how many 100 million people are vaccinated in the world.
Yeah.
So you do that kind of math, it's pretty simple.
Yeah. We have just a couple of questions, if you're okay with that.
Absolutely.
Wondering about RNA. Is it changing the body's DNA?
That's a great question. So RNA is like the, it's almost like a mirror image of what the DNA is. And it's called messenger RNA because it's made in the nucleus of a cell and it's transported out into the surrounding gel. We call it cytoplasm of the cell. So the nucleus is where all the genetic material is in the center. And it's a way of the transporting the information from inside the nucleus outside into the cell. And that's where ribosomes live. And ribosomes translate mRNA. That's all they do. And they make protein. They're little factories that generate protein. Once the mRNA has been transcribed and turned into a protein, it gets destroyed very quickly. So in fact, mRNA cannot incorporate into DNA. Just can't. It can't go the other way. There is a fancy enzyme called reverse transcriptase, which does that, but it's not found in humans. So it is very, very, yeah. So it's impossible to have mRNA go into DNA. How's that?
Yeah, that works. What about if a person tests positive for COVID, do they still get a vaccination?
So the short answer is yes. There's a longer answer. And the longer answer is the immunity you get from a natural vaccine or an actual natural infection is a different immunity than you get from the vaccine. Because when you get natural immunity, it turns out that you don't make immunity to the spike protein. You make immunity to some of the innards of the virus. So that means that it can then reinfect you potentially before your body will know that it's been infected, as opposed to the spike protein, which is the first thing that hits you and it knows right away. So it's a more robust kind of immunity to have the vaccine immunity. And secondly, for whatever reason, I'm not clear, but the natural immunity just wears off. Like in 6 to 9 months, it's substantially reduced, which I think is why, if you go back to the coronavirus as being a large portion of the common cold, it's why people get the cold every year.
Yeah,
you keep getting coronavirus infection year after year.
Someone's asking, after we get vaccinated, do we still wear masks? Everywhere's different, right?
So, that's a good question too. So, I mean, there's going to be a crossover between public health policy and individual risk and individual risk analysis. And I think that until everybody's who wants a vaccine has a vaccine, you're going to see public health guidelines suggesting wear masks.
Yeah,
I think so. Because it's too hard to say, yeah, if you got a vaccine, now you're in this group, right? And you're good.
Get your special button and wear it around.
That's right. Yeah. And so that's just not going to happen. So end of June.
Yeah. Till the summer. Let's just say till summer. One of the things out in the news yesterday for people in the news of vaccination is that the TELUS Convention Center is going to turn into like a super vaccination place. This is kind of cool in that you'll be able to take in like 1,000 people a day. Is that how that will work?
Oh, more than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. This is very exciting. So, I mean, we've been, it's an obvious part of the vaccination plan, you know, sort of it's waiting for the shipments of vaccines to really ramp up. And we're expecting that in April, May, we're going to have massive numbers of vaccine arriving. So you have to get prepared. And what I know about it is they're planning on like 100 vaccination stations. So when I got my vaccine, South Calgary, and there was, I think, 10. And so they're going to be able to process 500 people an hour.
Yeah.
So 500 an hour. And that's a shift of an 8-hour shift.
Way over 1,000.
Yeah.
How long is the vaccine effective? For example, Jim says the polio vaccines for your whole life.
So polio doesn't mutate much. It never has for whatever reason. The coronavirus is a little bit more stable actually than influenza, which changes a lot. And as you know, that influenza vaccine we give yearly because influenza, the strain changes from year to year, and it changes enough that it may evade the previous immunity that you might have built up. And we fully expect that the coronavirus vaccines will do the same thing. So the immunity to this particular strain of COVID-19 will last. We don't know how long it'll last, but the studies right now look like it's really, really what we would call robust. Like not many people are losing vaccine at a year out from those initial shots. And so that'll be fine, but it just, the next year's coronavirus will look different from, and sufficiently that we'll have to have a booster. And already, you know, we haven't talked about the variants, but this is part of our worry, is that the South African variant and the Brazil variant, for example, look like they do not, they can evade the immunity a little bit more than the other strains can, the native strain and the UK strain. So we are concerned about that for sure. And I know Moderna announced yesterday they're starting phase 1 trials. That's the testing in to test safety this week on a updated vaccine with the variants of concern added into their new vaccine. So by fall, I'm sure we'll have a booster.
Yeah.
So pretty crazy.
Very similar to just, I guess, when you compared it earlier to influenza, like there's always this updated version. Maybe we'll always have an updated version.
You know, my guess, I mean, these pandemics of coronavirus have been predicted for many, many years. I mean, we had SARS, then we had MERS, and we didn't hear about MERS, but the scientific world sure knew about it. We knew this was going to happen. And it probably will continue to happen in one form or another. So I think we can fully expect to have these kind of vaccine updates be part of our world.
Yeah. How would you describe the percentage of people vaccinated to have herd immunity?
I'll just throw out a number. I think 70% is a good number. That's fraught with debate. It depends on how virulent the strains are. And it depends on which 70%. So, you know, there's going to be some portions of the population that are more likely to transmit the disease. And if the 30% that are unimmunized are more in that category, then obviously the virus will still transmit in the community. And it just depends also on what we define as being like the herd and what kind of outbreaks we say are pandemic and what are endemic and all these other definitions. So, but let's say 70%. That's a good number to start with.
And do you think some of the hesitation for people in getting vaccinated also comes from, I don't know if it would be maybe not a full belief in the virus itself? You know, for example, I see people posting all the time like, oh, there was this many influenza deaths in Canada last year and this many pneumonia deaths. And we're not seeing those other numbers, maybe just not being published. I don't know kind of how that works. But then people say like, well, where did all the other deaths go? Like, and then it creates that confusion.
Can I answer that?
Please.
this is the challenge, right? And I gotta say, I mean, early on last March, I had this similar kind of feeling, like maybe this was really a mild illness. And really what we really needed to do was just lock down and protect our vulnerable seniors, because really those are the population it affected. But when you look at what actually happens, and we learned this at Cargill, I mean, we lost two workers at Cargill and one relative who was here visiting his son who passed away. So three people directly impacted with just going to work.
Yeah.
And we say, oh, well, that happened. That never happens with influenza. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
But if you actually look at the stats, so the statistics, I mean, 1 in 500 Americans died so far. Like, that's a massive number. And that never happens with influenza. And that's with lockdowns. Even the Americans, you know, did crappy lockdowns compared to ours. But, and then you look at our numbers, for example, we locked down like crazy. Do you know how many influenza cases we've had in Alberta this year? Zero. Actually, that's not true. We had one. It was a swine flu, which never happens. We had one case of a weird swine flu that someone picked up, and otherwise zero cases. And you'd say, well, because we're focused on coronavirus. Well, in fact, we've tested twice to three times the normal amount of influenza tests this year, looking for influenza. So way more testing than ever before, and zero cases. And so we've locked down to prevent the spread of infectious disease, and we've still had all the outbreaks and deaths. And we've had, in spite of what we've done, we've had healthy people who have died in excess numbers over what you'd expect in any other year from any other virus. So I think when you actually look at the numbers and take it seriously, you know, and look at it with an open mind, it's way, way, way worse than influenza.
And I think, again, it just becomes to how somebody presents a piece of information, how that gets possibly twisted, how it gets delivered. Like, I think that's where so much confusion lies. So people, even after that, like, still feel unsure and still want to have some sort of, I don't know, conversation or learning about it. Where's the best, most credible place for people to do that?
You know, I think that for me, there's another part to this, and that is the logic that flows. So if you take the position that coronavirus is a nasty illness and the worst thing we've ever seen, then by extension, you have to take action and look at what we've had to do. Many people call it draconian. It's unprecedented. Locking down, taking away personal rights and freedoms. I mean, it's crazy, the impact on our society and all the other things we haven't talked about, mental health impacts. I mean, we're not blind to all that. We know that. But if you start down one road, then that's where you lead to, is all these restrictions.
Yeah.
And no one wants that. And everybody's sort of looking, well, isn't there another way out that's less intrusive and less, you know, sort of an impact on our society? And I don't know the right answer, but what I can tell you is that when COVID hits bad in your own backyard, then it gets your attention. If it hits in your backyard and you sail through it and you're one of the ones that gets a mild illness, you'll look at it and go, what's the big deal? But in healthy people, it's, I don't know, 1 in 100. It's not that much. Still, that's 99 out of 100 people that get coronavirus go, well, what's the big deal? But 1 out of 100, you know, when we had 3,000 cases a day, that means 30 people a day were getting severe illnesses. Like, think about that in Alberta. 30 a day had bad, bad, bad disease. That was a lot of people. That is, sorry, but that doesn't happen with influenza.
No. No, I appreciate. And I thank you so much. We could probably talk for hours.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I just want to say thanks to all my medical colleagues. I often say that I just end up being the talking head here, but behind me is a team. Like, it's an amazing team here in High River and area, Okotoks, Black Diamond, Clarison, Vulcan, great docs, great nurses, great healthcare team. Primary care network's phenomenal. Thanks to all of them. And thanks to you.
Yeah, thank you.